Welcome to the Sharing Culture Podcast, the show that talks about sharing, who does it, why, the history, and a whole lot in between. I'm your host and executive director of Equal Giving Circle, AJ McCrary, and today we're talking about capitalism with Ms. Amber Boydstein of Spirit of Justice. We will have a book recommendation for you today, actually two, and a sharing activity for you as well. So make sure that you listen all the way through so you don't miss out. And I'm looking forward to sharing with you today. Welcome, welcome, Miss Amber.
Hi, AJ.
I'm so glad that we're talking about this today. So those of y'all that don't know Amber, she is the founder of Spirit of Justice. She's from Portland, Oregon. She's been doing community work, facilitation, anti-racist education, and a whole lot in between. She is a whiz at redistributing wealth and resources to community. She's an incredible advocate within our community. I love that she is a loudmouth like me, is unapologetic in both her advocacy and just also really like, hi, can we be practical? She's a mom of two beautiful babies and just an all-around dope Portlander.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to talk about capitalism.
Yeah. Did I miss anything? I'm sure I did.
That was above and beyond. Okay. No. Thank you.
I'm sure I did miss something. Like, she legit is a badass and does really cool things in community.
Thank you.
It's a joy to get to organize alongside of you.
Thank you. Thank you. I started work as a mediator. I think that's always just something I like to let people know that I, and I'm always an advocate for children and youth having the opportunity to learn about solving their own problems in schools. And I started that work when I was 13. So that's what helped me get to where I am now. So I always like to let people know that.
Beautiful. Yeah. Doing the damn thing. In a lot of ways, I feel like you're one of those rare gems in Portland because a lot of people in Portland, dare I say, are and can be complacent. Just go, you know, rather than being a disruptor and making ripples and pushing back, especially because Portland has this like reputation of being this really liberal, progressive place. But our faces right now. But it's not that.
No.
No.
Yeah. I mean, that's a facade for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing I think of when you say that people are complacent is, do people know how to be in community? Do they know how to build community? Ooh, and as you're talking about sharing, like, that's a key piece of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely is. Yeah. And it's, I'm really excited about this conversation because capitalism has loudly disrupted our relationship with sharing in so many ways. Mm-hmm. 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 And we talk about this a lot.
Yes.
So I'm going to ask you just a couple fun little rapid fire questions before we get into the meat of this conversation. Warm up a little bit before we, you know, ruffle feathers too much.
Okay.
Which we love to do. We love to do it. All right. What was your most favorite thing that anyone has shared with you?
My most favorite thing has been time and, recently had a friend share a lot of time with me, helping me heal and thinking about my whole life. People who have taken energy and space and held it for me. That's always the moments that I hold really, really dear.
I love that. I think a lot of people forget how important time is. I got to go to this lavender farm with a friend. She invited folks out to her friend's lavender farm. And it was so lovely. It was called like the Hope Lavender Farm. Mm. And it was really far out in Damascus. And I rarely go that way.
Dangerous for us there.
Yeah. But it was lovely. Mm. The people that own the farm were like really, really delightful and sweet. And it really did feel like a safe space. But it was so exciting just to share the day of time.
Yeah.
With this, you know, dynamic group of women. And yeah, just that time is really special. And I think in the hustle and bustle of capitalism, we often forget that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What was the most meaningful thing that you've shared with somebody? Like for you, that was meaningful.
I hope for me, advocating for young people has been something that I've really tried to share. The discomfort of disrupting the narrative that adults are more important than young people. Mm. And doing that within school systems and structures that are inherently anti-Black and anti-youth as a whole. And so whenever I speak up with and for young people, I feel like that's something that's powerful. Yeah.
That's really powerful. Yeah. That's really important. And I love like that you're holding these things close, because oftentimes people think about sharing as like, oh, I shared a coffee or I shared, you know, something physical. But sharing, and we were tapping into this practice, is so much more than just these physical, tangible items. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. I do appreciate that you advocate for the babies, because
You do too.
I do too. Yeah. But it's just needed. So I appreciate that you do it. You know, I love to see it. The summer of joy, you know.
Yes,
so.
Yes.
And what's Leo season we're recording this?
We're going to move into a Cancer moon. So, you know.
I know. It's summertime though. So as a Leo, I'm just like, we're almost there.
Energy's high. Yeah.
It's a vibe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. What do you share the most?
I really do think I share a connection to white wealth often.
Yeah.
I would say do that professionally often. And otherwise, I would say I share space. I try to hold space for people. Try to meet people where they are and without a lot of judgment, which is important for us to stay alive as humans. I don't knock judgment, although I try to show up without too much of that.
That's beautiful. You are an expert sharer. Love it. Love it, love it, love it. Sharing is life.
Yeah.
So what radicalized you? Because you are radical. And I understand that our relationship with this word in real life, like what we do should just be commonplace and the norm, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the things that like pushed you to be this person that is a disruptor and is a just an advocate and this like dope community member that cares and is not, you know, not making us, you know, eat expired food?
I think first and foremost, I mean, and I would say it's important to understand as a light-skinned Black person, having a Black father and a white mother, I would say growing inside a white woman was radicalizing in many ways. Being born in the 80s in Oregon in a state that, you know, never wanted us here. And then being in schools where I was the minority and not having access to any sort of system of support or community or educators that really were rallying for me. So there were moments where, I mean, I think in kindergarten where I was told I couldn't play with other white students because I was Black, you know, top of my head to the tips of my toes. And so that was a moment just viscerally I remember, and I'm advocating for myself with the teacher and the teacher not doing anything, and then asking to go to see the principal, and then the principal not doing anything, and then me coming back and just explaining to the, you know, kind of yelling at the students, at the kids, at the white kids. So I think very young there were moments, I have my Irish side of the family, and then I have my Black and brown side of the family. I have immigrant family. And so there were moments going spaces, especially in you know, educating. So very young, educating in rural areas. I worked for Clackamas County Family Court Services. That was their name at the time. And so going into, I mean, you talk about Damascus. So going into Malala or Estacada, I remember one time going with a white mediator and being told, we're in Malala, we had just come from a school, a middle school, and we went to go get some food. So we're at a restaurant, and it takes them maybe 15 minutes to seat us. There's hardly anybody in the restaurant visibly. They seat us outside, and then nobody ever came to serve us.
Oh my God.
And I was 14 then, you know, obviously I'd had many experiences prior. So I would say in terms of radicalization, there've been a handful of moments. And even recently, I've had some moments, you know, working with philanthropists and, you know, white mm-hmm. people who have power and access, and the way that they gatekeep has also radicalized me. So it seems to continue, unfortunately.
Yeah, I feel that deep in my soul a lot mm-hmm. in a way that I would like to reject, but I just can't because it's just, it is what it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I do appreciate your consistency and your fierce advocacy because I would definitely describe you as fierce.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we're going to get into capitalism.
Yes, let's talk about it.
We're going to get into it. Mm-hmm. So capitalism and sharing, these are two concepts that don't go together. Mm-hmm. They just don't. Mm-hmm. What are your immediate thoughts about that? Just like, we live in a society where capitalism is the focus and it has a chokehold on us. It just has this very loud chokehold. And in our work collectively in community, we are hyper-focused on sharing, on redistributing resources and disrupting systems and carving out a different experience. So I want to just hear a little bit of your thoughts about these two concepts, something that we're working towards, because to a lot of y'all might not realize that I use this word sharing as a reparations light term, because mm-hmm. reparations, I remember when I first started saying reparations and people, I had a girlfriend who's known me for like my whole life. She pulled me aside and said, AJ, you can't say that word. And I was like, girl, what? Why? What's going to happen? Is it, you know, that childhood thing, if you say his name in the mirror, then something bad's going to happen mm-hmm. to you. I was like, mm-hmm. is it like that? Like, I'm confused. Like, it's in the dictionary. It's been a concept that was used on other communities. Why can't we talk about it? And so she just kind of was like bewildered, like, that's not going to work out for you. And the more I use it, the more, you know, people get excited about it and are, you know, oh, maybe, And we use the word sharing as like, y'all can tap into your sharing, right? Like when you get into that, then we can start talking to you about reparations because you already opened the door. And reparations really is just sharing what you done took.
There's this amazing artist, Licity, who used to go by Damali Ayo, and she used to do reparations or panhandling. She called it for reparations.
Okay.
As a Black woman, she would stand on the street and she would ask for funds from white people. And then she would give it, I think it was like 2005 and six, she would give it directly back to Black people in real time. And it just makes me think right then, like that was that concept together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The underground plant trade during like the height of COVID, and definitely, you know, I don't want to say copied, but copied. The underground plant trade was they were connecting Black people with plants from white people, or like white people, just connecting the people. And so we adopted that concept for our plant jam. We were collecting plants and redistributing them. And that has been a really interesting practice in getting people to kind of engage with that, you know, and like people that love plants typically are people that already are engaged with sharing, because if you're a plant junkie, you're just like, let me, I got clippings for everybody, you know, let me share my babies for my mother plant or whatever.
Yes.
But it's like that introduction for folks to engage with these concepts and start to reconnect with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that concept of reconnecting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Much so,
especially as capitalism is just like literally sucking us all dry.
I was listening to Gabrielle Perry, and she was talking about how anti-Blackness is inextricable with capitalism.
Yes.
And she was, you know, digging a little deeper and talking about how everyone who unifies around anti-Blackness, it helps keep us oppressed, us being Black people oppressed, as we've always been a permanent underclass.
Mm-hmm.
And so thinking about, and especially, you know, there's been a level of engagement that shifted momentarily in 2020.
Momentarily.
Momentarily. only so much to serve them, them being white women.
Yeah. I mean, that moment in 2020 when people were like, you know, the social justice uprising, the racial awakening, whatever folks are wanting to call it, because it just definitely seems like, depending on which space, you know, it's called something different. But it was this moment of people were paying attention and engaged, but then it's like, oh yeah, we distributed like $1,000. We're good to go. What kind of math is this? This is giving me Common Core math. This is giving me some questionable, you know, student, you know, predatory student loan math, right? Yes. Like, what do you mean you did one little donation and you're good to go? Like, our community is at a 400 plus year deficit. In addition to just those years, what is piled on every single year because of literal white supremacy and hate, the oppression of capitalism is, you know, directly aimed at the Black community. 100%. Yeah. So 100%. It's like that quick moment. It's like, nah, y'all forgot a whole bunch of zeros. That was my favorite phrase that year. Don't forget my zeros.
Need 6 to 9.
Facts. Still today. Please don't forget the zeros. It is annoying.
I think that's when you're talking about sharing and capitalism and redistributing really generational wealth, right? Mm-hmm. And nobody is, I mean, what we are absolutely asking is that people be accountable for what they have.
Yeah.
And I think the narrative quickly shifts to a sense of blame. Mm-hmm. And that's where white people take it. That's where white women take it, you know, as they're really the ones that uphold and create the systems that continue to oppress us.
I think that like shifts into too, like when people are engaging with this conversation of reparations, which is literally just sharing what was never yours anyways. And they're starting to like deflect and be like, well, but I didn't do it. So I'm not the, you know, I'm also a victim in this. Not really. Cause like you have a nice house, like you're not worried about these extra costs. Like you are further along in this journey because of this. It really speaks to, you know, privilege. And it's too, you know, I'm very light skinned. I like to call myself neon black and it makes other people uncomfortable. I think it's hilarious. I'm an 80s baby through and through, you know? But we talk about privilege all the time as light-skinned folks and what that, you know, acts like, you know, proximity to whiteness, that access it gives us or that people want to engage with us and not hear, listen to, you know, more richly melanated counterpart or peer of ours. I think, like, when you start talking about privileges, it really brings stuff up to be for people because they also don't realize that beyond just your skin color, there are a lot of privileges to engage with, right? Like, are you able-bodied? Did you get access to, you know, certain kinds of education?
Absolutely.
Have you had therapy? Did you, you know, did you eat yesterday? Like, that's a privilege. Do you know where your next meal is coming? Are you pressed about, you know, I'm not doing that activity because if I fall and hurt my ankle, that's going to be, you know, I can't afford that, you know, so like privileges look like a lot of different things. And when we're talking about reparations, when we're talking about capitalism, we absolutely have to talk about privileges and that they look like different things. And nobody has the same two privileges, right? Yes. Like the bucket that I have is different than the bucket that you have is different from the bucket that this other person has. But when we don't engage with what our privileges are and be honest about them and like be intentional about how we're moving through the world with that bucket, we both can create self-harm and then community harm if you're not, you know, thoughtful and you're not engaged with what your privileges are in the society that is intentionally trying to snuff people out.
Every day, I hope that I'm reminded of the level of access that I have based on everything that you just spoke about. And my Eurocentric features, my proximity to whiteness, all of that. Absolutely. It should absolutely inform the way that we as people move through the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have advice or thoughts on how people can engage with their privileges differently?
Yeah, I keep looking at this quote that I wrote down about capitalism continuing to go on, and there has to be a permanent underclass that keeps socioeconomic tables moving upward and away from Black people. And I really don't know how dedicated white people are towards the liberation of Black people.
Fact. Say that again.
So I don't know, or in my heart believe, I feel comfortable being able to say this because I grew inside a white person, that white people really are willing to work around the clock for our liberation. Because as Black, and as Black people, even across the, you know, the melanin color lines, we are consistently under a level of genocide and attack from every socio political foundational system that's put in place.
Facts.
And so I don't know any white person that really is all in the way that they are willing to distribute resources every single moment that they can with respect to, you know, of course, like staying alive themselves. I look at, when I think about sharing, I think about as Black people, we are willing to just keep giving and giving and giving because we know that community matters, and we know that if you're taken care of, if your family's taken care of, AJ, like my family's going to be taken care of as well, right? And I'm not going to keep going on social media and asking for needs to be met. At some point, I'm just going to start talking to my community, and I'm going to make it happen, right?
Yep.
I'm just going to make it happen. And that's like, when I think about white people and redistributing their access and their time, I'm like, you all get so creative when you're thinking about your children's outfits for the plays that they're going to be in. If you're thinking about the foods that you want to make for their graduations, when you're thinking about your vacations and where you want to go around the world, you get so creative. And when you want to put in place a policy or a practice or a procedure, you all are really, really precise. But when it comes to the basic ways of being human, really, like your lack of humanity is pretty pervasive. Yeah. And so I don't understand what, I mean, I could say, please make sure the books that you read and the music that you listen to and the media that you consume and the people that you quote unquote follow on social media all hit these whatever, you know, anti-racist, pro-Black, African, you know, liberation. Although, I mean, you all don't want us in community anyway. That's why capitalism exists.
Yeah.
That's why y'all made a bunch of immigrant people who weren't white at some point, because you don't want us to keep building community together.
Yeah. Well, capitalism requires that severance of both community, that, you know, making interpersonal connections hard. You said something earlier about like the way that white people, you know, it's when it's convenient for them and they don't put that energy of like in the same creativity or care of things that benefit for them. And it just made me think about how the reality is what we are witnessing is white people are picking up their anti-racism action, or care like a coat. Right. They put it on when it's convenient, when it, you know, oh, it's raining. Oh, you know, something bad happened. Let me make sure everyone knows I'm part of the good ones. And it goes back in the closet. Right. Just to be pulled out as it's convenient. Whereas as Black people, it doesn't matter. It's like noticing that there's a young boy on the bus and like, I just want to make sure he's while I'm in his presence, he's good. You know, it's like, my kid's traveling right now, and the amount of Black people in New York who are like, but I got him, text him so he knows, right? Like that is, it is a different level of awareness and presence, even if it's inconvenient. Like I have a friend right now who it's inconvenient to be helpful to my child, but he's like, I got it.
White people are done when they're inconvenient.
Right. Mm-hmm. Where it's in, mm-hmm. you know, the Black community, like in yeah. our community, that's not a thing. It's
well, because they're not sharing, they're not giving to give. It's like a this gift that is has repercussions and, yeah. you know, like very specific rules attached to it.
Rules, yes.
So it's an and
which they like to say boundaries.
Well, it's not. It's, let's be honest. Like it's not an, you know, a little education for people. I mean, rules are requirements that we put on other people. Boundaries are the things that make us feel comfortable and safe as individuals. Yep. So it is most frequently white people give with ideas of how things should be used. Right, I give my time, my energy, my money. It should be going to these things.
Mm-hmm. Stipulations.
Mind you, no one delegates ever how they use their time, energy.
Oh, they get saucy when money. It comes up. It gets saucy, right? When you start like, what's your budget look like? Well, how many hours do you actually volunteer? What are you actually advocating? Are you willing to give up that job? This is a wacky story. New Orleans Art Museum just hired this white woman who has all the education credentials. Great. Mm. That's a story of access. Mm-hmm. To be the new like African art curator. And then the museum was like,
super... She probably had affirmative action to thank for that, but let's not go into that.
It's a lot happening in this story, to be honest. It's more than we can unpack swiftly, but it was interesting to see the comments of this and like the disconnect both from the museum and even many of the loud white people in the comments on the various threads about this, like not understanding, like, first of all, read the room. Mm. And just not understanding, like, even like what y'all are doing. Like, there's this huge disconnect of this, like, the lack of access when there's, you know, because she has these degrees and all of a sudden she's a good candidate. What? And not understanding like the not just sort of like how you could be helpful, but like, ma'am, do you really think that this is a good space for you? Do you really think that it's appropriate for you to take this seat? If you were educated, if you were educated, you would know not.
I mean, I don't know that white people ever think of themselves as inferior in any ways. Facts. They don't think of themselves as anything less than exceptional at all times. So there's that piece. I also wonder if this white woman didn't know what the heck she was doing.
Well, obviously she don't have very good credentials if she couldn't read the room. That like, this is in one of the...
But she probably thinks she's more qualified than we are.
Oh.
Which is just... absolutely in alignment with the delusion that they are swimming in.
Yeah. Yeah.
The falsehood of their supremacy.
Yeah.
Which someone needs to remind them of.
Yeah. It was just like, I really walked away from like reading all of that of just like, how could she have good credentials if she didn't know that this is wildly inappropriate? She could use those credentials in a much more interesting and impactful way to be an advocate that like, hey, hi, the college that I went to, y'all need to be giving scholarships out to, you know, melanated folks who want to study this. You could be advocating without taking that job.
They don't want that though.
No, I know. They don't want to do that kind of work at all. But you know what I'm saying? Like you could be using those credentials and what you learned in a much more impactful way outside of like, no, honestly, I don't even need to be saucy, but I know for a fact that what you curate is not going to be as fire as the Black woman with the same credentials. It's just not.
I don't know why it's so hard for white people to understand that. It's you can liken it to any other thing. If it's not your area of expertise, move aside.
And lived experience matters.
Absolutely.
Like lived experience and cultural connectivity changes the way that programs move, that visuals happen, like those are facts. It's not stuff that you can just replicate because you read. Like lived experience in a lot of ways. I noticed this is, you know, when I was younger in the nonprofit space, I'd be like, I don't want to deal with that because it's all of these, you know, white saviors, whatever issue it is. It'd be like, I volunteered when I was a teenager with CAP. I was really involved in that. And I'd be like, so, okay, I'm there because I'm a youth and part of this youth program. And I'd be like, Okay, I understand. Like, these are queer folks and they have a direct relationship to what we're advocating and the work that we're doing. And that makes sense. And they were always like the dopest adults. Then you'd have these other people, particularly white women. I remember there was a receptionist. I can't remember her name. I can see her face. I'd be like, but you're so rude. Becky. Yeah, definitely a Becky or a Sarah. Or maybe a Madeline. Sorry. I'm not always the nicest. I have my moments. But she was always so rude. And I'd be like, I just don't see your connection to this work other than it gives you a paycheck. Because you're not nice to anybody. And sometimes I would be there, like, you know, waiting for something or they're doing some little project. And I could observe how she would be treating folks that came in for different reasons. And be like, this does not make any sense. And so I always, as I got older, started to pay attention to those in the nonprofit space. And it'd be like, it makes sense if you have a cultural connection to this work. Right. You're able to move this in a more thoughtful way, in a more grounded way, just culturally competent and responsive in a more, you know, just a better way than a lot of these, you know, white women or white people who come from, you know, access or, you know, their knowledge base is a book. Where it's like, books are great and important, and we love books, but also lived experience really impacts this type of work, this advocacy, this moving of things forward. Because, you know, I could use EGC. Our whole team has tapped into some kind of social service at one point or another in our lives and needed services. And we're all appalled by the idea of, you know, receiving or getting expired food, because this is a direct practice derived from chattel slavery. I have over $117,000 in student loan debt, so I'm an expert on this topic, on this specific topic. If anybody wants to get in their feelings, you could also holler at paying that off.
Yes. Well, pay AJ if you're going to try to get her information around it, or you could just Google it.
Yeah, but like,
buy a book. Because the libraries are closed. You can't rent them anymore.
Oh, are they?
Many libraries are closed. Not all the libraries, sorry. Not all of the libraries.
I know the one in Killingsworth is under construction.
Yeah.
And so is the downtown one. Yeah, you're right. But, you know, we really move our work, and I know you do as well, from a place of lived experience and what we've wanted on our darkest days or when we needed to tap into services. And so it's really, you know, like the food thing, not only because we know what it's like to receive that, and we're not interested in it because it doesn't make things better. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely health issues concerning that. But we also know that the historic connection to that, and that is a huge no thank you. You know, like, why would I want to be participating in practices that are directly related to chattel slavery? Like, that's horrific. That's disgusting.
I've had lifelong repercussions for our health and epigenetically as well, which is something that we have to factor and consider.
So just so those that don't know, again, holler at Google, go to, you know, rent a book, borrow a book, read something, buy a book. One of the practices that enslaved people had to endure during chattel slavery was receiving expired food, receiving, you know, scraps, literal scraps. And many people did you know, survive by having small gardens they tended or foraging, which then later was outlawed. So that's why we have a lot of the, you know, you can't touch these plants kind of laws, or you can't loiter in these spaces. But knowing that expired food scraps is the way that our ancestors were forced to survive, like, to give me scraps or to give me expired food, that is a visceral reaction. That doesn't make me feel cared for or loved or like you actually planned for to be supportive, right? It's like an
humanizing, because I'm not a hostage. And so don't feed me like I'm in a hostage situation.
Yeah, it feels like an animal. My dog loves scraps, but I mean,
And it was, I mean, they weren't giving us scraps that were organic, non-GMO, halal.
Oh, yeah. No, Drake has a life.
No, I mean, it was, yeah. I mean, and you talk about small farms. We can talk about watermelons. We can talk about, mm-hmm. you know, the ways that we as Black people on this land have continued to practice moving from surviving to thriving, and the ways in which, again, mostly white women have thwarted that with such vigor.
Yeah. Capitalism is so, it's like, it's interesting because if we start engaging with like what we have collectively lost and what is collectively happening, it's wild how people are, and particularly white women, like you do know that the ruling class, they have no interest in actually protecting you. They use and abuse you just like everybody else.
They should know that. They vote them in. They by should, the masses.
They know, it's like they should know that, but it's like it's a thing that they regularly as a group, as a demographic, are push away from that. They regularly are like, well, I hear you, but one time, this is a really wild.
I mean, isn't that whiteness that you get to pick and choose, right? And facts. you get to choose when something doesn't apply to you. And it's because it's all made up.
It is all made up. Yeah. I one time witnessed an elder. This was a wild day and a wild event. I'm not going to get into all of the details. But she, during this, like, I don't know, there was literally like 40 white women in this room at this giant, or all these tables were pushed together. It was like a big conference table, but then more tables connected. And she was getting, we were talking about race and like activism and activating. And she just snapped at one point. It was like, well, y'all is the one raising them. And when I say my spirit jumped out of my body and was running around the room screaming, laughing, because I was like, I was not, it just took a wild turn, right? Like, yeah. You're just weird. Yeah. Things were happening. And then she just was like looking at these people and was like, but y'all are the ones who are raising this.
Yeah.
Like, and it was then to witness the many of these white women's faces is like they had not, for many of them, it had never dawned on them that like, but y'all are the ones doing it.
I work, I mean, you know, obviously in education, work with a lot of white women who will say things like, oh, at my children, half of their allowance goes towards giving in some form. And I'm like, rich person or well-off white person or white person. Mm-hmm. White person, if you're giving allowance, all of that for your child goes somewhere productive. None of it gets saved for them because they already are receiving generational wealth. So I think when we're thinking about capitalism and sharing and what white people can do is they can be relentless in giving up their sense of freedoms and liberties every mm-hmm. day. You know, zero vacations that year. Why not? Why not go to the park in your neighborhood or another park? Why not mm-hmm. walk there? Why not use public transportation? Yeah. If you're able to walk, I don't know, you know, abilities. Why aren't they consistently, overwhelmingly trying to shift the narrative? If they were to, when you say like they're raising the children, I'm like, if you were to die today, what do you leave behind? You leave behind this other being, these beings, these small beings that believe again that they are superior in all these ways mm-hmm. because of how you move through the world. And again, it's more than a book. It's more than a movie. It's more than your posts. It's are you in your private life without sharing consistently giving up those comforts? And they aren't. They aren't.
No. Because it's also, it's like to disrupt capitalism, you have to start engaging with your actual practices. What are you actually doing?
Yes.
Not, and like social media activism is an eyesore and a joke. The actual return on interest in terms of social media, like, and nonprofits and community work and even reparations, we're talking about a 1% mm-hmm. ROI. This is not mm-hmm. a fact that I came up with. Mm-mm. Again, you can email me. I'll give you the notes because I didn't know I was going to mention that today. But my email is info@equitygivingcircle.org. I will happily share the information in more detail, but a 1% ROI. So if you're on social media talking about this is where I do my activism, that's not an ROI that anybody return on interest wants to rock with. That's not it. And yeah, what are you doing in your actual lives, and what opportunities are you, you know, are you funding? What are you giving up? What are you, you know, how are you really teaching your children a different legacy?
I know no white person that's given up every vacation for the year. I know no white person that has given up an extra car or an extra home. I'm just given, and given without, again, stipulations of how they will be used.
Yeah, no strings attached.
No strings attached, which is actually how you give. Just in general, just a facts. Reminder that when you give something, it should come from this place within you. And of course, there will be psychologists that say that all giving is a way for you to just be giving to yourself, because you're. But that's an aside. I would say that giving should come from your heart, and you should let go of any attachment to how it's used, because you've already just, that's the act of giving.
Well, if there's an attachment to it, and it's, now we're talking about a transaction.
Yes.
This is a sale.
Yes.
If I give you something and I say, okay, I'm going to give you this book, but you have to do X, Y, and Z. No, this is no longer a gift, because a gift is no strings attached. A gift is, I give this, whether you read it, you leave it on the park bench, you give it away to somebody else, that's your business.
I might give you $1,000 redistributed white wealth for health-related reasons, and you might use it on a night out.
And that's part of wellness.
Part of wellness, absolutely. And I'm do not need to know, do not care, as long as it's being used in a way that's in alignment with your life.
Yeah.
Great.
I in like the mutual aid work that I do and with redistributing resources, I actually hate hearing this is what I don't need a receipt. Mm-mm. I, as a person, am not the most excited about paperwork, like just unnecessary paperwork. Don't sign me up for another portal. At all. Like, I just don't want to do it. I mean, I have to oftentimes because of my job and like grant writing, but don't give me extra paperwork, extra, like, okay. Mm-mm. Did you, like, all I want to know is, like, did you get it?
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I don't even really care, you know, if you say thank
you. Just like in a white transaction when you're paying for your child's school. Just want to know that the kid got in. We don't want to know how they got in. We don't need your like white. We want you to do it like you do with other rich white people. You don't ever talk. You just, it's done. It's taken care of.
Yeah.
That's it. So just like that logic.
Yeah. I mean, and think too, like really start engaging with capitalism. Like what can you, like going back to that point of like, what can you live with?
Can you engage with anti-blackness?
Can you engage with anti-blackness?
Can you engage in it? Because it is, like we said, inextricably linked with capitalism. And it is the bedrock and the foundation of all of our systems that are in place, all of our institutions that are in place.
Mm-hmm.
So can we engage with that consistently?
Yeah. And can we be mindful of like our privileges as we're walking through spaces?
Mm.
Because I think there's a lot of, I would say within like even the, you know, EGC community, folks that are fans of ours, who will say, you know, white folks who are fans of ours, but like, I don't have a lot, but you have something. And it's also like understanding, like, even if you don't have a lot, you actually have more access. You have like, there are things like that you can do.
You can give up your house and move into an apartment, because the chances of you being able to buy a house again are so much higher than systemically oppressed Black people.
There
are many things you could do that are uncomfortable for you that you don't want to do.
I mean, you should, if you are not doing things that are uncomfortable, you're not disrupting capitalism. You're
but every
definitely,
day, all the time.
All the time. But if you're not doing things that are uncomfortable, you're not disrupting systems. You're not living an anti-racism, like an anti-racist life. Because to truly engage with disrupting, to truly engage with redistributing wealth and resources is to be in a place of discomfort, of a place of I'm actually having to engage with this, think about this, and move differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people don't realize how much excess they really do have. Mm-hmm. And also even like the ways that they can leverage or engage with their networks. Because it's also like, if you are a white person who is excited about, you know, participating as a giver to, you know, organizations like ours or volunteering, are you inviting your friends with you? Mm. Are you bringing this up in the group chat constantly? Are you challenging your friends like, hey, now, I didn't say anything that one vacation because whatever, whatever, but like, this is the third vacation you're going on a year. You should be, if you are really about this anti-racist life, you should be saying to your bestie, like, you know, I think you should stay home and donate those dollars. You could still have a nice day at the park. You could still have an, you know, you could still do something nice for you, but like mm-hmm. yourself, because I'm not saying like,
the park is nice.
The park is nice. I mean, there's tons of different like local things that you could like, why aren't you like living in some discomfort and being more generous? But if you're not, if you're an individual who's like, I'm about this life and you're not inviting people in your intimate life mm-hmm. to match you mm-hmm. or calling them out. Like, I had some friends, I went to Xavier. And so I have a lot of friends that are doctors and pharmacists from college. And in the height of COVID, many of them, and these are all like Black folks, Xavier's and HBCU in New Orleans, that, you know, they pretty much have been traveling a lot, which is cool. Like, I'm not coming for y'all. But then to see a lot of them in COVID, they stopped traveling, right? And they were grounded. And I was like, cool. Well, where's the receipts of you giving back to the community? Where are you making sure that the college students behind us are taken care of? Mm-hmm. Where, what are you doing? And I had a many tense conversations. And mind you, this was with Black people that I'm like, I know that you have access. I know that you have bumped up financially. So white people, you really should be doing even better. And it was a beautiful exchange, tense at first, but like, of like, as a friend, I expect better of you. And don't be over here hyping up my page or like, AJ, this is amazing. This is so great. When you just over here now hoarding dollars.
Sure. So what comes to mind when you're speaking is that you have a praxis and that many of us have a praxis. And that involves us consistently reevaluating the ways that we can show up for the dismantling of oppressive systems and the liberation of Black and all people. Right. Mm-hmm. And so there's that piece. And then there's also just in general, when we're talking about sharing and we're talking about capitalism, we're talking about Black people, you're saying, hey, I went to my Black community about issues that literally are fundamental to our liberation. Mm-hmm. And we all leaned in with discomfort because we're all uncomfortable all the time anyway. And we figured it out because we know how to community. We are a community. Many of us do. And I'm not saying overwhelmingly every Black person has had it. We're not a monolith at all. But overwhelmingly, that's what you try to take from us, white people. And that's mm-hmm. what we continue to build roots around.
Yep.
And so, white people, where is your humanity mm-hmm. in this? Where is your stake in this? Yeah. And it's not. I mean, it's really. And also, I mean, I think white people are willing to be devious and they're willing to uh-huh. lie to their family and to other people to get what they want and need and move forward, or evasive, or just a lack of transparency. You can use all of that to get us funds.
Right.
So when your grandparents are saying, let's go to Disneyland every year, or let's, you know, whatever, let's go to this foreign country for just whatever the heck you want to do for a vacation, you can take those funds and you can redistribute it. Mm-hmm. Your hands are not tied. In fact, you have a lot of space to pivot and get creative and shift the way your epigenetics are predisposed around the falsehood of white supremacy. And again, you can research that. That's not me just putting together a bunch of words and hyperbole. Like, it's literally biologically, we are the way we are because of where we come from and what we surround ourselves with.
Yep.
And so to be a sharing community within a capitalistic society is, I think we continue as Black people to try to break free and create something different. I see mm-hmm. us doing that again and again and again.
Yeah.
That's our praxis.
Mm-hmm. I would also say too, like, just from like this part of our conversation, reminding white folks in particular that a lot of talking about reparations and capitalism disrupting systems also is about our basic communication skills. And the way that y'all are shutting down or avoidance or not wanting to engage or be responsible, and you are responsible because you have inherited the dollars.
White women don't hold other white women accountable like you held your other black community accountable. Yeah. White women want to move themselves away from those white people.
Right, it's always
those over there. And I'm the anti-racist and I have my anti-racist book club and I redistribute funds to all these groups. And no, you got to pull in all your people. All of them have to be pulled into a conversation like daily.
Yeah. And the reality too is
I don't want to hear about it.
I just want
you to do it.
Yeah.
I don't need to hear about your racist white family because I'm black in Oregon and in the U.S. and in the world.
So you already know. We deal with this, live this experience every single day. It's interesting too, because like in that of me being able to just be like, hey, I have some questions. Mm. I'm a little annoyed with some of y'all. I'm frustrated, right? We were able to have a dialogue. Sure. This did not end in a single friendship, by the way. Did not end a single friendship.
It
was
a call.
It shouldn't. It was a call in. It was a dialogue. It was, you know, a somewhat of a heated exchange with a few people. We got a little saucy with each other. Can we check my coin? I did. I checked your coin. White people will not have that. Mm-hmm. Like there is not that call in. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's immediate shutdown. It's like, mm-hmm. but if I really love you, I really care about you.
Yeah, and they take personal. It right. It turns and it's about them.
But if I really care about you,
yes,
I'm going to be able to have a hard conversation.
Yes,
and still come back. Maybe we might need a couple days to cool off. Maybe we even need a mediator. But mm-hmm. if I want to have a hard conversation with you, hire her. But if I want to have that conversation, it's because I care and I want to build with you.
Absolutely.
If I don't want to engage with this, like the white people, the white women who are in that book club but aren't talking to their neighbor or calling out their favorite aunt or whatever, or just in avoidance, it really speaks volumes about where you are in this journey and the way that you are willing to disrupt. And if you really care about those people, you really care about this cause, you're going to be discomfortable and engage with those people who are, you know, problematic and racist and harmful. And you're going to continue to talk to them and call them to, you know, to be better. Mm-hmm. You're going to be uncomfortable.
Yes.
Both in your dollars, your wallet. Like if you don't have a line item for redistributing wealth. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't have to be just with our organizations. Like,
no,
you know, like. Find a cause or five.
In addition to.
But find multiple causes.
This is an and.
Yes, it is an and moment.
Find multiple causes. I want to say the way I stayed and have stayed until recently, my grandmother who's 92, my Irish grandmother who has dementia, until recently with her dementia, the way I stayed in her ear around her level of anti-blackness was just, I was consistent. And I was consistent because she was in book clubs, because she had a level of socioeconomic status, because she had status in her Catholic church. And there became a moment where she was recommending books to her book clubs that were books that I read from Black and Brown authors, and they were reading them. And then there were times driving when she was in her 80s when she would say, oh, I realize I got to go because of white privilege, or there's that white person using their white privilege. And so she was connecting the dots. And then at some point saying to me, oh my gosh, we used to have minstrel shows at Madeline Catholic Church to raise money for X, Y, and Z, and unpacking that in her experience growing up. Was it uncomfortable? Absolutely. Black people are raised to respect their elders.
Mm-hmm.
That was not and has not been a comfortable place for me.
Yeah.
Can I do it with grace and love and with knowing that literally my life as a light-skinned Black person is not nearly as oppressed as our richly melanated, you know, family and friends and community. And so I just need to keep doing it for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
White people, you can do that too.
Yeah. You bring up a point, like, why is it that, you know, us as Black folks and the whole African diaspora globally are expected to be uncomfortable?
Sure.
As just a norm, or, you know, somebody just told me a story of like some conflicts happened at her job and this white dude was like coming at her crazy. This is a richly melanated sister. And she was like, I was really confused the entire time that like, how come HR was trying to basically just like let it be blah, blah, blah for his comfort. And yeah, because I was like, yeah, but what about your comfort?
Mm.
Like,
I mean, we can spin off on that when we talk about capitalism and we talk about, let's just talk about medicine and let's just talk about our bodies and whose bodies are deemed, able to take more pain. Richly melanated Black women, our bodies have been experimented on. Mm-hmm. And that's literally the reason why we have so many medications today that heal us is because Black women are not perceived as sacred and divine and worthy and human.
Meanwhile, the reality is if it wasn't for Black women, nothing would be happening or running.
Again, Googles.
Googles. Google, you're out there. Let me get a sponsorship, please. Since I've now given you a couple free ad bits, you know how to reach me.
Read some Baldwin.
Yes. Davis, I mean,
Angela
like
Davis.
It would be so interesting if the whitest city in America truly tapped in, was actually progressive. Or even like even some of these, you know, liberal people, like if you were actually liberal, if you were liberal with your caring, if you were liberal with your, you know, connecting to community, like that would be such a cool thing to witness. Mm-hmm. And miss me with like, oh, I went to this, you know, show or I shopped at such and such shop. That's capitalism. Mm-hmm. That's not building shit. Mm-mm. Doesn't build anything. Mm-mm. That disconnect of like, but that's, you know, entertainment and shopping is not building community. It's not, you know, changing pathways. It's not disrupting systems. Mm-hmm. It's literally just feeding the beast. And you feel better about it because you bought a bag from a Black person or you, you know, ate at a person of color restaurant. You know, disrupted nothing.
Yes. I think it's like on their to-do list every month. It's a handful of things they need to do, you know, that they think fall in alignment with being anti-racist. And I just remember, I'm always sort of reminding myself what brings me back to my humanity every single day. And it's not a checklist every month. It's every single day, every single day. Am I leaning in? Am I checking in with community? Do I have a pulse on what's happening around me politically, otherwise, in my own sphere of neighborhoods? Like, do I know what's happening on my block? Do I know what's happening with the youth? Do I know anybody's name?
That even that level of consciousness and connectivity, especially in the Pacific Northwest for white people, is this like really loud disconnect. Well, this is a really good segue. I'd love us to hear a little bit more about your work with Spirited Justice, which is this really dope organization that does both redistributing of resources, wealth, events. You've had many, like, I've enjoyed some movie nights and conversation. You do a really amazing job of bringing intergenerations, so, like, having intergenerational conversations and making sure to make those connections. Is the cooking class still happening?
It wrapped up. Okay, we had a six-week African cooking class for free, online and in person. It's really beautiful.
It was really beautiful.
Teaching families how to cook. And if you're interested in that link to those six classes virtually, which was filmed in 4K, Epic Studios, shout out, also with We Out Here magazine and a handful of other collaborators, Keto Wellness, Akilah Collins, Miss Akilah, she actually did the class. You can reach out to me at amber@spiritedjustice.org. Yeah. Cooking classes is over, although I would say, you know, my organization focuses on consultations around equity and justice. We're an abolition organization. So my roots are in mediation. So really, I think of the transformative justice umbrella. And so work that falls under that with conflict resolution, teaching in schools, restorative justice, interrupting the school to prison pipeline. Historically, my organization has done a lot of work around that in PBS and neighboring districts as well. And then we also do a lot of meditation. And so that's always a key piece of any part of our trainings. We have space that we do that in person and then also virtually. Always trying to figure out how to infuse our brains with oxygen and give us the tools that we need to remember how to stay most aligned with whatever part we want to. I'm not going to say your highest self because people don't always want to be there, but sometimes they need to be in an aligned space. So that's like, that's sort of the three key areas is consultation, mediation, and meditation. And then all of the things that you spoke about are really the areas that I try to give back. Shout out to my aunties, my uncles, my grandparents, my ancestors for instilling that deep value of the level of community, which is continuing to give and not for a monetary value, but to be together. And so we try to throw events. We did a lot of spoken word for every month for a year at a Black-owned coffee shop that shut down. Shout out Shalimar and Holy Beans, and movies for a while. And I'm always trying to figure out, again, bringing groups intergenerationally together for our collective joy and education, and just to give back with like no strings attached, like just show up and receive. That's my fun.
I love that. What's one of your favorite? I know people like don't like these kinds of questions. I'm like, what's your favorite thing that you do? But what is one of the things that in your work that gives you the most joy, that brings that smile? She's glowing right now, y'all. She's glowing. So there's a good answer there. Yeah. There's something, something juicy.
I absolutely, I so love, and maybe you'll get this, like I love being in uncomfortable conversations with people and supporting people and growing through their discomfort. Like I really, really love that. And so whenever I get to educate around abolition and equity and justice, race-related topics, I'm just kind of in my space because it's really fun to push people because I know the other side holds so much value and so much good. It really, really does. Like it levels us up when we go through those uncomfortable things as a community together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of healing in the discomfort. I've had to, not had to, but I've, over the last couple years, I went from being like, I really like being behind the scenes, AJ, and like doing stuff and like making connections and whatever, whatever. And then between EGC and just running for city council and like all of my mutual aid work, I became like on stage, AJ.
Yeah.
I hate it. And it is.
But people loved it.
People, and they still love it. Like I met an AJ, a fan yesterday, and it went in an unexpected place. Yes. And she's delightful.
Yes.
She's an older, she's an elder in the community. And I was like, oh, really now? Okay.
It's the youth and the elders. Those are the best blessings, yes. Right? When they appreciate you.
So, I like to lean into the uncomfortableness. And that elder, she had made a comment, and this is a quote that's like, think of the hardest thing or the most scariest thing possible, right? Like think about your fears. Mm-hmm. And then she said, do that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's with you. Like, I don't want to do that, but do that. And for me, definitely is just like a neon Black person to be this loud advocate. I don't want to say I don't have to, but I'm also like a wild card for a lot of people in that regard. Mm-hmm. And so I just like, I love that of like being, pick the hard things and go for it. Mm-hmm. And like, I definitely, in terms of both personally, like EGC, you know, even running for a political position, if I like shied away from the hard things, because like our work at EGC, and I know your work at Spirited Justice, this isn't easy, just in terms of the emotional labor and in terms of like the fundraising and the coordinating logistics, like these are not easy things. If they were, everybody would be doing them. But I know for me, committing to this hard thing and then even like publicly doing this thing that was definitely out of my comfort zone, I've learned so much, and I've, you know, gained friendships and gained just, you know, different perspectives. And I just really love that, like you're also your love for like lean into the hard thing. And that's an invitation.
Yeah. Yeah. Because what you're saying, it bettered you.
Totally.
All around.
I mean, it made me louder.
Yeah.
Made me way louder.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you saw your limits, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. In a bigger way.
I think also when you like go and you face the scary things, it's also a reality that like, Oh, okay. I can do this. It means like you start kind of looking for scarier things. And I do not mean like, I don't know, rock climbing or base jumping. If that's your thing, that's not what we're talking about. Like the emotional scary things.
I might
things.
Be talking about rock climbing.
I mean, like if that's one of the ways, but I mean, just... Yeah,
nothing. We're not talking about like inherently dangerous just to be dangerous.
Yeah, the discomfort of like you
to
know
push for growth.
Yeah, pushing for growth, like emotionally, professionally,
yes.
In unexpected ways. Mm-hmm. Like it might be really hard to give up an opportunity because you know you're not the right kind of candidate that really should be in that. Like that lady at the art museum, right, in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. If she really was about this work and this life, she would know that this is not appropriate for a white person to be in that. And honestly, even a light bright. Like there are richly melanated women, particularly I'm saying women, who have, you know, PhDs in curation, art history, the works, who have, you know, decades of experience. That should be their job.
Absolutely.
I want to see what they do. I want to celebrate that, you know, so like, yeah, leaning into this discomfort. I love that you also engage with that. And it's an invitation to all y'all listening. Join us.
Yes.
It's actually fun over here in the discomfort. You know, we laugh.
It is. Because as AJ said, we do it for to build community. And it's not to shame. And it's not to point a finger at. It's, again, to call in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's like... in the action, in the discomfort, that is where the growth, that is where the beauty is. That's where it lives. That's where the magic happens. When you're comfortable, nothing changes for anybody.
Mm-mm.
Doesn't matter what the topic is, but if you're just comfortable, it's just going to be stagnant. Mm-hmm. And if you push yourself and you really commit to that engagement, that is where things move. And it's interesting, too, because I think also when you start engaging with that discomfort, you can start, it's like a self-awareness moment of like where I do need to grow, where like, oh, I'm probably good, like to leave this part of me alone and start trying to, you know, tend to this. You know, you might realize I volunteer a lot, but I don't share my dollars.
Mm.
Right. Or for me, like in the last couple of things, one of the things that I've in my own discomfort is like I'm real good about like advocating close, like within the city, but sometimes on like even bigger spaces or platforms, I'm like, oh, AJ, you can be a little shy. You gotta, this is where you have to be loud, sis.
Yes.
Like, this is where you have to like be, you know, I'm pushing myself beyond like the comfort of my hometown. You know, I don't, it's easy to make a ruckus here. I really understand the history and the nuances. Okay, so now it's like part of my next journey is like talking and explaining to other people what's happening here and why this is dangerous and why this is impacts everywhere. And part of that, for all y'all listening, is Portland is a place that is teaching sustainability and, you know, urban development and transportation to the entire globe. Right. Like people want to know about our relationship with recycling and our relationship with public transit. This is dangerous because what we are teaching is, you know, the erasure of Black folks, both looking at our history and policy, redlining. Like, you know, Oregon was a place where it was just not hospitable to Black people. It was illegal. Right. So really understanding how those practices are showing up in our day to day. And I, as a person, like, okay, now I got to start again making sure these other people, as they're romanticizing this place that is not romantic, right? So that's like my new discomfort is I'm in those other spaces where I'm like, I know that you love Portland because of the beer and the weed. Like, cool.
Mm.
But you want to engage with it, the fact that we don't have tons of Black brewers or like it's really hard for Black people to be in cannabis and, you know, like, and getting people to see those dots. So like, come with us into this discomfort.
For all of our liberation.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. So then I guess my last big question for you is like, do you have a question for me?
What does love look and feel like for you?
Ooh, what does love look and feel like? Definitely consistency. Consistency, time is absolutely important. It is like my love language. I would say also like genuinely taking the time to get to know like me and vice versa. Like mm-hmm. I want to know that if I like the difference between I have a girlfriend that I know that she prefers dried flowers or paper flowers. And if I was to bring her flowers, that's the kind of flowers I should bring. I know like one of my best friends, she always puts me onto music and I know that's how she thinks about me. And it's like curated really specifically to what I listen to or my vibe. You know, one of my other best friends, we fight and we get into some real nasty. I'm like, I feel violent right now. I'm so upset.
She's family.
This is my sister for sure. But the fact that like no matter how tense of a conversation that we have, mm-hmm. that she is like, well, I'll talk to your ass tomorrow, like good or bad, mm-hmm. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Like we could get into it. We don't have fights all the time, but like we get into it. I know she gonna send me a meme in the morning and be like, I mean, I'm so mad at you, but like, did you see this?
Yes.
You know, so time, I think really like knowing people and being consistent and like being committed to the bumps of relationships, mm-hmm. you know, interpersonal relationships, it's not always smooth. Mm-mm. And just, I think really like, I feel personally the most loved when people meet me where I am, where they're intentional about like, you know, I know that this AJ will feel seen or cared for. Mm. And just like, I say also communication, like I don't need you to be there all the time, but being like us to have a respectful communication, like communicative relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think, I love that question. I think like love is such an important part of this work.
Yes.
But it's also the way that we as a society talk about love is always like romantic love. And like, that's nice. That's wonderful. But there's so many other ways that love is like real and present and, you know, bountiful and important.
You made me feel loved as community last week. I had to reschedule our meeting a couple times at the beginning and the latter part of the week. But your response to me when I was saying like it's embarrassing to have to reschedule again, because it is, because we're both busy, busy women.
I'm not bothered.
Was, again, it's something to the effect of you weren't bothered and to take care of myself. We have time and check in next week. And I had never in my life received a message like that professionally. And it just like all of my stress just dissipated and I was able to actually rest.
Good.
And I actually rested and then I actually got better. And I think I wouldn't have been able to rest if the response had been different, because I did feel a sense of urgency and importance around showing up, right? It's important to show up, to do what you say you're going to do. Rescheduling once is crappy, rescheduling twice is really uncomfortable. And so I felt a lot of love and care there as community. And it was a first for me.
Oh, thank you for sharing that back with me.
Of course. Absolutely.
I think it's so easy to care about people. Mm. Like if you really, like if that is where the intention, and I'm spoiled. Like I have a network of people that I have, you know, gathered for decades that I have different kinds of relationships with, like, at the end of the day, I know I'm very loved and cared for. And it's such a joy to give that back in different ways and try to meet people where they are. But also, like, kindness is free. Mm. I have absolutely, there is a person that I have rescheduled, like, I kid you not, like, 7 times. We still don't have a meeting set up. I don't even have a good excuse at this time. Like, at first I did. But now, it's just like, I mean, does it have to be a Zoom? So, like,
yes.
But it's, you know, I really deeply feel like being kind and caring and, like, also.
But it can be synonymous with honesty, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and how do you want people to respond to you? Like, if I have to reschedule, do I want somebody to, like, flip out and have a meltdown about it?
Yes.
Or do I want them to, like, be calm and, like, you know, okay, cool, no problem. I want them to be like, cool, no problem. Like, and honestly, it's not the most inconvenient thing in the world. Like, we act like things that are inconvenient. Yeah. Like, we have a real, real wacky relationship with what is inconvenient. Like, like the
That's
other day,
podcast.
It is. The other day I was in this Lyft and this dude, Lyft, you could holler at a sponsorship too. you got two organizations right here. You know how to find us.
I only ride Lyft over 500 rides.
Oh, you can put, you know, we can have a sticker or something. Like, holler at us. So we're in this car, and this individual was like freaking out about traffic.
Just give us some cars, and I'll drive AJ.
There we go. All right, we brainstorming. All you got to do is show up. So this individual is like freaking out about traffic, and I'm like, what was wrong? And I can very much tell that they're riled up and they're trying to get me riled up. And I was like,
it's an invitation to the chaos.
Yeah. But I was like, okay, but this isn't inconvenient or anything. Like, this is traffic happens, sure, particularly at this time of day. Like, and also,
this is predictable.
Yeah. And no one knew, like, in this exchange right here between me and you, no one's died. No one outside the, you know, the vehicle, like, we, everything seems fine. There's a little traffic. Mm-hmm. If I really needed to be there earlier, I would have left earlier. Mm-hmm. That's it. And mm-hmm. So it's like, it was this moment of me being like, our relationship with like what is and isn't inconvenient is like, an inconvenience is like a childcare mishap. That's a really frustrating inconvenience. Mm-hmm. You made me the wrong coffee. Yeah.
Oh, I have to have an uncomfortable conversation with my brother or sister because they're racist.
Yeah. Like, Let's like really engage with, yeah, what is an inconvenience? What is actually, you know, a true discomfort or a hiccup, or, you know, and like, how are we engaging with that?
Like, because one is a choice, right? Like, facts. One, like, I am choosing to go and get a coffee from somebody, which already is a privilege, facts, and already is a level of, I mean, we could talk about classism and we can talk about continued enslavement and mm-hmm. who's working where, why. That's mm-hmm. a whole other conversation. Although it's important to recognize that's real and that's present, right? And so I'm making a choice to get a coffee. Coffee doesn't turn out how I want. I'm making a choice to talk to my racist family, and it either turns out or doesn't turn out the way it wants. Having a child care mishap is something that's happening to you.
Yeah.
That's an inconvenience. If you were choosing, that's not an inconvenience. That's an invitation to lean into the moment of life, mm-hmm. because life is not always joyous, and it shouldn't be. It's ceremony at all times, sure, but it is not always joyous.
I think in our expectation about that, like, balance of joy and discomfort and life, a lot of people struggle with that, the reality and like engaging appropriately. Yeah. These are the same folks that are afraid to engage with their privileges and be, you know, responsible regarding what those privileges have or have not given them.
That's the falsehood of capitalism, yep. right? That you can just buy your way out and everything can always just work for mm-hmm. you, and you stay on this high. But that also messes with your chemical, in what's happening with you inside and your chemical balance.
Yeah.
It gives you like consistent dopamine spikes, mm-hmm. which are unhealthy. And so I just kind of bring it back. I'm like, yeah, like, this is another way that capitalism is continuing to oppress us as a whole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to just real quick quick shout out, the sharing disrupts a lot of like that biological, those notes that you were just talking about, like, biologically, when we share, we're tapping into our humanity. And it, mm-hmm. that is one of the things that starts to disrupt capitalism. Like, mm-hmm. capitalism has tricked us into, yes, I want to buy this new shirt. Yes, I want to buy this. I'm going to, you know, because it gives us a dopamine hit when every mm-hmm. time that we're buying and we're purchasing. And as we're engaging in that system, and that's a big part of how it has, you know, just spiraled and has consumed us. Well, sharing does that too. Sharing also can be free. You can share your time. Mm-hmm. When you start being intentional about how you are sharing, where you're sharing, what you're sharing, who you're sharing with, and it becomes a literal practice, mm-hmm. you start to get that dopamine hit,
yes.
in the way that you get that dopamine hit from the spending, the mm-hmm. the purchasing, the, you know, these luxuries, or even just in the other kinds of ways that we can get dopamine hits, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, absolutely.
Sharing and laughing are two mm-hmm. really organic, natural ways to get those dopamine hits. Yes. Those disrupt capitalism.
Yes, we're such powerful beings, and it doesn't take that long to rewire our brain to start to scan the world for different ways of looking and thinking. I mean, really, it's like 21 days of every day consciously thinking about three things that you're thankful for. And after that, your brain is literally rewired to start to look at the world differently. And so we can do that in so many different ways.
Facts.
Biohacks, people.
Biohacks. Right. On that note, because we could keep going and I can't even wait to listen to this. Like, for real, for real. This is a great conversation. I always enjoy spending time with you and talking with you. My brain just like goes and goes and
goes. Same, same, same,
same. So we have two book recommendations for y'all. Are you ready? Are you?
I'm ready.
All right.
I'm absolutely ready. Well, I wanted to recommend Working Towards Whiteness, How American Immigrants Became White, not just generally because I think it helps people understand that as time has gone on in the U.S. for immigrants, how it became more politically expedient for many immigrants, Irish, my family's Irish, Italian, we could name other groups of people, to become white. Mm-hmm. And then the ways in which all of these groups of people that in the past were in some form a little bit, although they were sometimes indentured servants and not enslaved and hostages, they were banding together in some form with us to try to get access, resources, a sense of sovereignty. And now, because of them being coined white, they overwhelmingly are supporting levels of anti-blackness that continue to keep us oppressed. And I would say email me for other, for black and brown authors that I really, really, really love. But I think that's just for white people. Often it's helpful for them to understand that history there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Know your history, y'all. Learn about it. Be uncomfortable. If you are not uncomfortable by history, you are not reading the right history. Mm-hmm. You're not engaging with the right history.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, so the book that I'm going to recommend is The Whiteness of Wealth. It's about how the tax system impoverishes Black Americans and how we can fix it by Dorothy A. Brown. And she's incredible. This book is great just if you're trying to understand the legacy of taxes and how this has absolutely targeted Black people and how white people have really come up using the system. It talks about some overall arching, you know, commentary and facts and realities about wealth. It is a really beautifully written book. I know sometimes my recommendations are kind of on the technical side, but this is I feel like it's not an easy read because it is a lot, but the way that it's written, it's very digestible. It's very approachable, which I think is just like speaks to the writer, both in their talent and in their voice. And so holler at this book. It is wonderful. Going to just shout out Third Eye Books. If you need books, go buy them. And they also can order books for you. So if you have titles that you are interested in, you can just ask Miss Michelle and she will work on that for you. She's wonderful. Absolutely delightful. A true community gem. And so get you some books, support Third Eye Books.
Their son, who used to work at Harriet Tubman Middle School, just had a child. So shout out to new little revolutionary in the world.
Yeah. I saw that announcement.
And I was trying to think of a book that wasn't so heady. We both recommended heady books. I'm like,
That's
what
okay.
do people? Okay. All right.
That's okay.
Okay.
You know, if you need a book recommendation that's super light about that everyone has a part and everyone's part is important and to lean into your part, go read Richard Scarry's Busy Town. There's also a cartoon. So if you need a quick gathering of yourself, holler at that. I do love it. Children's books are absolutely great tools in learning how to be good humans. Yes. And sometimes us grown-ups should go there, but definitely check out these books. Amber, can you just let folks know where to find you, how they can tap in and support?
Yes, you can find me on all socials, except for Threads right now, because I don't know if I want to permanently delete my IG if I have to delete Threads.
I know, right?
joking. Under Spirited Justice, website the same, and Amber at spiritedjustice.org.
Perfect. And do you have any things coming up? I know this summer you are working on collecting and redistributing dollars. Mm-hmm. I think by the time we air this, our workshop will have already been passed.
Yes.
But I know the other thing that you've been talking about is getting a building. So I just want to shout out.
If you
want to
help me buy this merchant hotel in Old Town, downtown, please send me an email. I would love to be a Black woman that owns that building and makes it a co-op and works with Black brown community. I'm going to have an art show, art swap coming up in July. I'm supporting a handful of events, and then we'll be kicking off a lot of my education in schools in September. I'm working with a handful of different schools. But ways that the community can engage with me would probably be through spoken word. I'm going to bring back my spoken words and poetry. So that'll be August on monthly, and you can go to my IG to find when that'll be.
I love it. All right. So if y'all want to connect, please definitely do follow along social, send some dollars. Dollars, don't forget her zeros. Not kidding.
AJ and I said 6 to 9.
Yes. All right. And if you don't have them by yourself,
before the period,
before the period, get in your group chat, because your intimate community can absolutely help you be your own giving circle, to distribute resources, disrupt capitalism, and to redistribute money today. So that is a call to action. Equitable Giving Circle, we've got a bunch of different programming coming up. Holler at our website, equitablegivingcircle.org. Holler at our Instagram, because we older millennials and that's where we are. Equitable Giving Circle. We do have some interns coming this summer who are maybe going to help us branch out. I'm very excited about them.
Watch out for Equitable Giving Circle TikTok.
I know, right? That actually is my intern is going to be working on. And I'm like, I can't even wait. We are always trying to grow our giving circle, Equitable Giving Circle. So sign up as a monthly donor, send checks, send money. Please donate both to our organization at EGC, as well as Amber's organization, Spirited Justice. Truly, truly engage with sharing and talking about it. If you are doing this work and you're not loudly talking about it, you have an issue. So whoever you are, really, you should be talking about Black liberation, anti-racism, and the different ways that you can show up in community. Do that, please, immediately. EGC always needs volunteers, and we've got, you know, different programming, like I said, to tap into. So we'd love to see your face. We'd love to get to know you, because building community is an everyone activity, and we're doing it together, and you're invited.
Yes.
Our homework for the day, some of y'all are going to love this one, and some of y'all are going to be real saucy. Your homework for the day is to really look at your budget. Our EGC's housing director, Lillianne Green, says, you know, show me your budget and I'll show you what you care about. And I love that quote. And so with capitalism, right, we're talking about capitalism. We're talking about our money. We're talking about what we're spending it on. Sit down and look at your budget. Really see what you're spending money on. Really engage with where you can share more, where you can cut back, and where it's safe for you to be uncomfortable. Like, we're not telling you to make irrational decisions. Mm-hmm. Like, that's like extremes on any side is too much. But we are inviting y'all to really engage. If you're Uber eating, stop that. Make a sandwich. Eat at home. You got food inside. Stop doing that and redistribute those dollars. You know, maybe you could cut back on your shopping. You shouldn't. One of my girlfriends is always like, no shopping unless it's at, you know, used places. And I love that challenge. But like, where are you spending your money? Because you probably have extra dollars that if you are more responsible. So please, your homework is to look at your budget and really engage with what you're spending your dollars on and where you can redistribute money and where you can share better or differently. I like to say that if your budget doesn't have two line items of giving, right? One, giving to an organization or multiple organizations regularly. You've got to, if you don't have that, that's an issue. It should be a reoccurring donation. It should be something that you're engaging intentionally. And then you should have another, at least one other line item of where you're giving direct to community. So mm-hmm. when you see mutual aid asks, when, you know, the neighbor kid is selling something, you just mm-hmm. just make a donation. You don't need mm-hmm. to participate. Just make a donation. Being really intentional about sharing those dollars. So you really should have two different line items, and maybe it starts small and it's something that you grow with. But that is the homework assignment for you to really look at that. And if you want a bonus homework assignment, get your friends and talk about their budgets. Mm. Call them in. What are you spending money on? And if you brunching with your homegirls or your home dudes or whoever it is that you be brunching with, y'all have a big responsibility to talk about your money, because brunch is not cheap. So if you are happy houring, you are brunching, if you are Uber eating, you especially need to Uber. You could holler at a sponsorship too. you also know where to find us. But really engage with what y'all are spending on and talk about it in your community. Like, if you're not talking about money, you are not doing anti-racist work.
I love to talk about money just quickly. And I recently was working with an organization in Multnomah County, and I was asking everyone I worked with how much they made. Ooh. And I shared first, you know, how much I was making. And I found out that their DEI trainer was making $10 less than I was, as someone that was just facilitating meetings. And this was their DEI trainer, who was a richly melanated Black woman, for their whole organization that didn't have a DEI trainer for 105 years prior. And so I was appalled, although that just at least started a conversation, mm-hmm. and put it really on Front Street for people. I think transparency is super important, and it helps get systems moving.
Yep. And you got to start with your intimate community, because mm-hmm. if you're not willing to do mm-hmm. like have this uncomfortable conversation about I make this much, I give this much, mm-hmm. I could do better here mm-hmm. with your friends.
Yeah.
With your family, with people that you consider your intimate community, your circle, you cannot do this in, you know, a public way. It's going to be hard for you to call your boss out. It's going to be hard for you to be disruptive or to really engage in other spaces or places intentionally. And so, yes, have these conversations, talk about money, look at your budget, and we look forward to sharing with y'all next time. Thanks for listening. Thank you so much for being here, Amber.
Thank you,
yeah. Happy sharing, everybody. Sharing is life-giving.